Okay, just a brief review of last week. All we talked about really was why this is an important study. And the heart and soul of that is that Jesus instructs us to watch and be ready in Matthew 24 and the apostles as well in their writings on the issue. And in order to watch and be ready, we need to know what we're watching for. One of the main descriptions that is given of the end times, the last days, whatever phrase you want to use to describe them, is that it will be a time of great deception. And we're going to get into more of that as the class progresses. But if deception is the game that we are going to be facing, or the threat that we're going to be facing, that deception, obviously, we already face to some degree now, but that will get more intense. And so if we are to be the church that endures, we need to be knowing what's coming so that we can be watchful, so that we can make good decisions now in preparation, and so that we might not be already deceived today about various things in the life of the church. There are many examples of deception in the church right now. Many examples. And one of the things that we'll be finding in the class as we go forward, and certainly at the end as we look back on it, is that accepting any deception now, it just paves the way for accepting deception in the future. And that's one of the reasons that the church has to be so concerned about holding to the truth and not falling prey to things that are not the truth. Now, to start with this week, I'd like to read Matthew 24 again. And I would like for you to follow along with me, please. Matthew 24, page 959 in your pew Bibles. And I want to do that because it will help prepare us, again, for what we're going to be talking about today. Today, on page 3 in your materials, and by the way, if anybody doesn't have materials yet, there are new booklets, extra booklets on the pedestal and over on the chair there. We're going to be talking about today three different approaches to the issue of biblical prophecy regarding the end times. There's mainly three schools of thought on biblical prophecy regarding the end times. We're going to be going through those. And now, one of the main reasons why there are three schools of thought on this issue is because the material on the issue is looked at from different perspectives or in different ways, right? I mean, if it was all, if God said, look, point one is this, and point two is that, and point three is that, and point four and point five, there'd only be one view on the issue, right? We just give those points, one, two, three, four, five. But the prophecy in general, is less obvious than that. And that leads, that's one of the things that leads to various perspectives on these passages. So we're going to look at the three main perspectives on these this issue of prophecy. And it will be helpful for us to have Matthew 24 in our minds as we think about why each of these different groups says what it says. Because each of these different groups could point to something in this passage and say, see, that proves that what we're saying is true about biblical prophecy. Okay? So, Matthew 24, beginning at verse 1. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He said. I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be on those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform many signs, great signs, and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, there he is, out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It would be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. And he then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of, he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Okay, three approaches to this issue of biblical prophecy regarding the end times. It's as easy as the past, the present, and the future. Okay? Trying to think of easy ways for us to remember these things. Three different ideas about biblical prophecy regarding the end times. Think of it in terms of the past, the present, and the future. Okay, the first is those who would see biblical prophecy as being things that happened in the past. Those are called preterists. Now, if it's easier for you just to remember past, just remember past. But this is the official term of this school of thought, the preterists, or the preterists, however you want to say it. And they believe that by and large, all of the prophecies in Scripture with regard to what is believed to be the end times, and they would have to say believed to be, because they say those things have already happened. Okay, so the things here in Matthew 24 that Jesus is talking about have already happened. Therefore, the things that Paul talks about in 2 Thessalonians, those things have already happened. Now, how can they say that these things have already happened? What is it in the passage that they might point to as a way of saying that these things have already happened? In fact, they have to have already happened Yeah, Josh.
When he says this generation will not
pass away. Right, yeah. Dave brought up the question last week, but that verse where Jesus says in verse 34, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Well, if he means by that the generation of people living in that day, then it must have happened because they're not living today. Okay? We'll come back to that verse and try to sort out what that does mean a little bit later on. Anything else in the passage that people might be able to point to and say, well, those things already happened? Yeah, the temple being broken down. Not one stone will be left on another. Now, today there still are some stones on another, right? That's called what? The Wailing Wall, right. That's still part of the temple. But essentially, the temple was demolished. Now, when did that happen? Does anybody know? 70 AD, right? In 70 AD, Jerusalem was sacked and the temple was demolished. And people in this preterist camp would point to 70 AD as the day of reckoning. Okay? And that's when these things happened. So those two pieces, that being asked about the temple and Jesus talking about, well, as he's leading into his comments, that you see these stones here, not one will be left on another. And then saying later on, I tell you, truly I say to you that this generation will not pass away before all these things happen. They say, well, the dates line up roughly within a generation or so. And so that's central to their understanding of biblical prophecy altogether then. Another thing that's very important for them, well, dates are always important for them, okay? I mean, in terms of when things were written. You see, if things are written before 70 and they say things like this, then it fits into their theory because 70 then would bring those things to a conclusion, a fulfillment. But really important in this is the date of the writing of the epistles of John, 1 John in particular, but also of the book of Revelation. Because he talks about the temple there. Now, there's some question as to whether it means the literal temple in Jerusalem or a figurative temple. But the vast majority of scholars believe that those things were written in the 90s. Well, if those things are written in the 90s, and they're talking about the temple, then maybe that would sort of speak against this, that this isn't the great fulfillment of everything, okay? So they try to make the case that it was written earlier, like in the 60s sometime, but it's a hard case to make. So anyway, that's the first camp, all right? The past. These biblical prophecies about, quote, the end times happened in the past. And we'll get back to that and more of what that... We're going to follow these schools of thought through the next couple of weeks, okay, and how they relate to other issues with regard to the end times. And also how they then, as we talked about last week, how they affect, how taking any of these positions affect the way we see ministry, do ministry, and structure ministry in the present. Okay, now the second one, let's jump down to the future here, okay? I want to do the present at the end. The future says that all these biblical prophecies about the end times, they will happen. They haven't already happened. They will happen in the future. And what about Matthew 24 sort of falls in line with that thinking? What kinds of things does Jesus talk about there that you say, boy, I haven't seen or heard about that happening? Okay, those celestial signs, right, of the end, okay? What kind of descriptions does Jesus give about this?
In the
sky. Okay, stars will fall from the sky, right.
See now.
Right. In verse 14, it talks about the preaching the gospel to all the nations of the world. And in verse 14, at the end of verse 14, it says, and then the end will come. And the way he describes these things here, he speaks about the end over and over again. Well, if these things were all fulfilled in 70 AD, then that was the end? What are we living in now? If the end has already come, sort of. Right, right. And the description of his return, right? As lightning that flashes in the east is seen in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man, and all nations will see him, and they will mourn. Right? If you take that even close to literally, you really can't say that that's happened yet. I mean, these people would say, well, he came in a figurative way in with judgment to Jerusalem in 70 AD. So that was sort of a coming, his coming. But, you know, the people who here say, wait, these things are going to happen in the future, they have a point. It doesn't really seem like those things have happened yet. Now, what problem do these people who say it's going to happen in the future, what problem do they face about this passage? What would these people argue against these people? Get around that passage somehow. It says this generation. And so if you look at commentaries on that verse, this generation will not pass away before all these things happen, you'll see people working at trying to figure out a way to make that word generation not mean generation, as in the group of people living right now. Okay. Now there is one place in the New Testament where it's used that way in Acts chapter 8 verse 30, used in a different way, Acts chapter 8 verse 34, where Luke is quoting from Isaiah, where he's talking about the suffering servant, and he says, "And who can speak?" And most of our translations, I think, say, "And who can speak of his descendants? For he was taken out of the land of the living." Right? This prophecy about Jesus being crucified. But the word that's used there in that Greek that Luke uses is generation. In other words, "And who can speak of his generation? For he was taken out of the land of the living." Now, when he uses that word like that there, then you can sort of say, well, maybe that means descendants. Maybe what Jesus is saying here, there in verse 34 is this race of people, these descendants of Abraham, these people here, as a race, as a group of, as a family, so to speak, will not pass away or they won't go away before all these things take place. So that's sort of the debate that goes on between the preterists, the people who look at these things as happening in the past, and the future people who look at these things as though they were happening in the future. And the future people have a real inventive name. They're called futurists, which makes it simple. Futurists. Okay, so we have this on the one hand, and we have the future people on the other hand. But then in the middle, we have the present people. Okay? And those people are called the historicists. Historicists. And those people say these prophecies about the end times are happening right now. They are being fulfilled. Present tense. Okay? Now, I would ask you what you think that means, but I don't think we got a lot to go on yet. So I want to explain this a little bit better. And to do that, well, we'll come back to exactly what they mean by that, but I want to go on to Roman numeral 2 here, that these three approaches stem directly from three different understandings of biblical prophets or seers. Okay, that word seer is used oftentimes in the Old Testament to describe a prophet. They see, and what do they see? They see the future. So these three schools of thought are related, really grow directly out of three different understandings of what a prophet sees when they see something. Okay? Now, that flips pretty easy. Okay, number one there, we'll do the past people, okay? They believe in nearsighted prophets. And what they mean by that is that prophets see things that are very near to the days in which they make their prophecy. And especially as it regards most everything, that they speak about things that are coming fairly soon. So that's one way of seeing prophets. And there are multitude examples of prophets prophesying about things that are going to happen very soon. The people, now I got these, this order, number two is actually going to be for the future people, okay? So you can, well, it's in there, in parentheses back there. They believe in farsighted prophets. Prophets, they don't concern themselves with especially as it regards the end times. Those prophecies, those aren't about the days that are quickly coming. Those are about centuries and centuries and centuries in the future. Those two things are related, obviously. Their view of how a prophet sees and their understanding of when the things the prophet sees are going to happen, right? The prophet is somebody who sees things, especially as it regards the end times, as happening far into the future. Now, the middle one, which will go together with the present people, okay, that these things are being fulfilled in the present, they believe in fully sighted prophets. Well, not so much 2020 as a little bit different thing. And I want to draw a diagram. On the next page, you have space there for an illustration. And I hope that I can get it all on this, well, that I have the right space on this board to get it. Let's say we've got three prophets here. I've been practicing all week. Okay, three prophets, okay? Now, in front of those prophets, what they're seeing, okay, the object of the prophet's vision, let's think about it as a mountain range. Now, when you look at a mountain range, all the mountains, well, first of all, you see the smaller ones are in front of the bigger ones, right? No matter what side you come at it from, typically. And they look fairly similar, usually. But what you find when you get to the mountains is that what looked like we're right back to back, you got to go a long ways to get to the next mountain. There's a lot of space in between them, okay? But as you're looking from a distance, they just kind of all look like one lump of mountains. Now, let's say that one mountain is here, and the other mountain is here. So they're looking at a mountain range, okay? But depending on where they are, they're going to see it differently. They're going to see different things. For example, this guy down here, he's our nearsighted prophet, right? Because he's in a position where he can only see the one mountain, the one coming up. And that's the sort of dynamic that the past people have, right? The nearsighted prophets. This is what they see. They only see the things coming right up in the future. But this guy, he's in a position where all he sees is the mountain way in the distance. So those are the two opposite ends of the spectrum. But the fully sighted prophet, the people that say that these prophecies are currently being fulfilled, right now being fulfilled, he sees both. Now, as a prophet, he doesn't know about this gap. And you see that in prophecy in the Bible over and over again. That prophets see, they see something, they speak about what's coming, but their sight is somewhat limited. And there are many examples of the fact that they place together in one prophecy part of a description of the early mountain in the range and part of the description of the bigger mountain, the farther mountain. Okay? Now, we'll get more into that in just a second. But now think of how this helps explain what Jesus is saying in Matthew 24. Is Jesus in Matthew 24 talking about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD? Well, by this understanding, your answer would be yes. Is Jesus only talking about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD? No. Inherent in this understanding of the way prophets see is the understanding or the belief in multiple fulfillments of prophecy. Prophecies oftentimes have more than one fulfillment. Now, that word itself, fulfillment, is an interesting word because it can be used in different ways. What we tend to think about when we say a certain prophecy is fulfilled, we tend to think of it in terms of the prophet sees a particular event a long ways away, and suddenly that day comes, boom, the prophecy is fulfilled. But the Bible doesn't use that word only in that way. Okay? Sometimes it will use that word as saying that this particular happening fits very well with the prophecy that so-and-so spoke way back when. That doesn't mean that it's the only example of a situation that fits that prophecy, but in that way it does fulfill or it ties into the prophecy that was previously given. Now, there are many examples of this in Scripture. But before we jump to those examples, I want to go back to verse 34 and the question of if this passage has anything to do with the future, like our future, and not the past, it wasn't fulfilled in 70 AD, then how do you explain verse 34 where he says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away before all these things," as the NIV says, "all these things have happened." Well, as I said earlier, the future people, as they're looking at that verse, they're doing their best to figure out a way to make generation mean something besides the people who are alive today. And as I said, there's at least one verse where that word is used in a different kind of way, in a sort of an extension of the descendants kind of a way. But I think that the word that we need to look at is not the word generation in that verse, but the word that comes at the end, which here in the NIV is translated, will happen. Okay? Because that word means something a little different than will happen. The word is genomai, and it has various meanings. It means come about, or originate. So it has with it both the idea of happening, but also the idea of starting to happen. Okay, in that sense of originate. Now, if you think about the multiple fulfillments of end times prophecy as a series of things, and we can only draw two of them out here, but as a series of things, and you look at 70 AD, if we want to call this first mountain 70 AD, as part of that, but also the other things that Jesus describes in Matthew 24 as all part of this progression of events that Jesus is talking about here, then that word seems to fit perfectly, right? It's not as though Jesus is saying, "Truly I say to you, before the people who are sitting around us here die, every single one of these things is going to be in the past." What he's saying is this package of events is going to be so clear to everybody because it's going to start happening while these people are alive already. Now, there's another thing that speaks in that direction, and that is the next verse. Look, if you will, with me at verse 35. Let's read verse 34 and 35 together. It says, "I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." And as I said, it can be translated various ways, and you will see that if you check other translations, they're not quite sure how to translate that word. Okay? But then he says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away." Now, if you read those two verses, one after the other, and you're understanding what he's saying in verse 34 as saying that this generation here will be here for the whole package of events, verse 35 really doesn't fit. "I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." Okay, he's talking about the time when they're going to happen. But then he says, "Heaven and earth will pass away." Well, yeah, you just said that. "But my word will never pass away." What is he reinforcing in verse 35 as sort of the exclamation point to the previous point? His word is good. That means you can take this to the bank, all right? that these things are definitely going to happen. So when you put that with verse 34, what he's saying is, his point here in verse 34 is not to say, give the end date of when all these things are going to happen. His point is that my word is so sure, my word is so definite, that even the people living here among us right now are going to see these things begin to happen. Okay? And so he's already talking about, and we'll get to some of these examples here in a second, of this growing, building, multiple fulfillment kind of prophecy. And then the things continue to build until they get to the ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy, which is then the end, when Jesus comes and his coming is viewed and the nations mourn, all those things. Okay? So seeing prophecy in this way, and this is even before we get to the biblical examples of it happening, even if you just want to take my word for it at this point, it helps explain why prophecy reads the way it reads. Now, what you'll find when you look at Old Testament prophecy, especially during Christmas season, is we read these prophecies with regard to the coming of Christ. Have you ever gone back to read those Old Testament prophecies? Some of them. When you read them in their context, you go, ooh, wow, that seems like a stretch. Almost like those apostles were just kind of padding their argument a little bit, thinking that people wouldn't go back and check or something. One of those is, let's look at the Isaiah 7, verse 14 example there on page 4, 2b. Isaiah 7, verse 14. We talked about this a few weeks ago during Advent and just made brief mention of the fact that the situation in Judah at this time is very tense, very disturbed, because their brothers to the north, Israel, the northern 10 tribes, have joined forces with Syria, their neighbor to the northeast, and they are preparing to march into Judah and conquer it. And King Ahaz is very upset about that, and God tells Isaiah to go and give him a message that not to worry, because I will protect you. Well, Isaiah isn't listening. Isaiah says, no, I don't, because he says, ask for a sign, and God will give you a sign that what he says is true. And Ahaz says, no, I don't want to ask for a sign. Which sort of on the surface looks like humility, but it's not humility. It's that Ahaz, he doesn't think there's anything to this to begin with, because he immediately goes to another king to try to see if he can broker a deal and have him come and defend him. Anyway, during this discussion that Isaiah is having with King Ahaz about whether or not these northern kingdoms are going to come down and conquer him, he says, because you won't ask for a sign, the Lord himself will give you a sign. And what will that sign be? The virgin will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, is Isaiah there? Is he looking like this? Here's this huge mountain that's right in front of King Ahaz, and God says, look, God wants you to have a sign that you're not going to get conquered. And that sign is that 700 years from now, the Messiah is going to be born. What? How does that help me? It doesn't help me. But in the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 1, what does Matthew say? Matthew chapter 1, beginning at verse 22, ending this explanation of what happened when Joseph was visited by the angel or in the vision. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. Well, there's a lot of questions all of a sudden that come to mind about that, isn't there? One of them is, do you mean another child was born of a virgin before Jesus? Well, no, not exactly. See, a lot of times the events of Mountain 1 are similar to the ultimate events in Mountain whatever, the one at the end, but aren't completely like it. They hearken back to the prophecy, but they don't fully complete it as such. And what seems to be the case is that as Isaiah, and since we are talking about a different story, we want to talk, take 70 off there, as Isaiah is giving a sign to King Ahaz about this crisis that's impending, he seems to be indicating his new wife, who at that time is a virgin, or soon-to-be wife, the one who's betrothed to him, that she will conceive and bear a son, and before, and the prophecy says, before the child is old enough to know the right from the wrong, the good from the bad, this won't happen. You'll see that it's not happening. And that, if you trace the story into Isaiah 8 and Isaiah 9, that's what happens. Isaiah's wife has a son, and before he's even barely old enough to be able to have a conversation, the situation that's impending on them is resolved. God intervenes, and they aren't conquered. But you see, Matthew knew that, right? Otherwise, Matthew was a horrible student of the Old Testament. He knew that. But he also knew, see, what my contention is not just that this is the way that we should see biblical prophecy about the end times. My contention is that this is the way the Bible sees biblical prophecy about the end times, or about anything. Because this prophecy about the virgin bearing a child is not about the end times, and yet there are multiple fulfillments of it. It happens right away as a sign, but its ultimate fulfillment is in the future. And that's the way Matthew understood that. That here we have not just a woman who at the time of the prophecy is a virgin, we have a woman who at the time of conception is a virgin, at the time of birth is a virgin. So it's fulfilled in its fullest extent. Does this make sense? Prophecy has multiple fulfillments. And that is the way that we need to see and read the prophecies about the end times. So the battle is not, is it only about the past or is it only about the future? It's about the present. Now, why do we say the present? Why do we have to see all of these prophecies about the end times as though they are being fulfilled in the present? Well, because they are. Because the church from the very beginning has been living in those things. They have been living in persecution. They have been living in a world that is often fraught with wars and rumors of wars. They've been living in a world where there are often earthquakes and various kinds of things. And so, wherever we are, and that's what's so important about seeing Jesus as saying, look, my word is so true that I can tell you that before this generation dies, they're going to understand that these things are indeed the future of this world. Because we live after them and before the end. So we live with our own mountain, so to speak, that we face. We're looking ahead because the end is coming, but we're also living in the end times. Will there be a, in capital letters, end times, as in those last, very last days? Yes. But we believe that we are in the end times all of the time from Christ's ascension to his return are the end times. And so these prophecies about what will happen, and we'll get back more into this when we talk about Antichrist. Because all through the history, people say, oh, that's the Antichrist. Oh, no, that's the Antichrist. No, that one over there is the Antichrist. Were they wrong? Yes and no. Was it the fullest fulfillment of Antichrist? No. Was it a partial fulfillment of the spirit of Antichrist? Yeah. So if you see yourselves as living in the end times, then you understand that this watching and be ready and the nature of our needing to ward ourselves against these things is stuff that we have to be concerned about right now. And that, as I've said already, has a great amount of effect on how we see ministry. What we believe ministry has to be about. It even changes the way we see missions. It certainly changes what our invitation is to people to come to Christ. Because any invitation to people to come to Christ, which does not make it very clear what that means, Which means, as he said, if anyone would come after me, they must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. Take the same path that I took. Walk directly against the prevailing winds. Any invitation to the Christian life that doesn't include that is a misrepresentation. If you just tell people, become a Christian, and now you're locked in, you're good to go, baby, you don't have to worry anymore. And life, Christianity especially, is about abundance and prosperity. Not only does it not fit with the biblical testimony about what the life of Christians is and what the future of Christians is, it doesn't serve them well to walk it, because everything that they run into, they see as a shock. Okay, now, very quickly, number three, there on page four, application of this principle to the issue of Antichrist. Well, I sort of already did that. In terms of Antichrist, there will be, as John talks about, in 1 John 2:18-25, what he says there is, he's talking about the Antichrist, but he says, already many Antichrists have come. So see, even John, as he's talking about Antichrist, he's talking about the Antichrist, but says, but you need to understand that many of them have come. We've had Antichrist since Jesus ascended. They just keep coming, trying to teach something other than what he taught. But at the same time, he talks about the Antichrist, the complete fulfillment of that spirit and the kinds of things that he has described as doing. And the Second Thessalonians passage there is where Paul talks about the man of lawlessness, and speaking of the man of lawlessness. And so when you're reading these descriptions of the end times, and you see that they're indicating some of these things have already happened, well, all you have to do is just say, well, I guess I'm standing like right here. And some of these things have already happened. They're in the past. But those things being in the past only testifies to the fact that these are coming. And so we need to prepare and watch for the things that are coming. And this also, by the way, helps us explain why Jesus says something like he does in Matthew 24, where he says, about that day or hour, nobody knows, not the angels in heaven, not even the Son, he says. Only the Father. So, well, wait a minute. How can, if they're one being, how can the Son not know? Well, during Jesus' whole ministry, he has two natures, right? He has a human nature and a divine nature. And they are fully connected without being mixed. But there are various times when Jesus is speaking more out of his human nature, and there are times when he's speaking more out of his divine nature. And when Jesus is speaking in Matthew 24, he is speaking as a prophet. Okay? He's not speaking necessarily, I mean, even though he is God in his essence and man, he's not speaking from that. He's speaking as a prophet. And so he's seeing as a prophet sees. And so in terms of the days and the hours, I don't know. But these are the things that are going to happen. So watch and be ready so that you're not caught off guard. All right, so, in conclusion, only the historicist understanding of end times prophecy is true to the prophecies themselves. Just think of Matthew 24, right? It's got various things in it. You go, well, that sounds like, yeah, I guess it should have already happened, and that sounds like it's going to happen. So this is true to the prophecy itself. It helps explain the whole prophecy and to the Bible's own treatment of prophecy, as we saw in Matthew chapter 1. Seeing that the prophecy about the virgin conceiving was not just for Isaiah's day, but was in its fullest extent for our day and for the coming of Christ. The question is, when you speak about the Antichrist, do you include things like humanism and those sorts of things? When you speak of the spirit of Antichrist, absolutely. You speak about all things that are in opposition to the truth of Christ. When you speak of the Antichrist, then you're speaking about something a little bit more specific in terms of a coming
Lord Jesus, we know that, as we talked about before, all things are in your hands. You told your disciples that all authority in heaven and on earth had been given to you, and that they should go into all the world and make disciples. We know what it means to be a disciple, Lord, and we pray that you would continue to form us into the fullness of what being a disciple means, that we might truly be able to deny ourselves and take up our cross and follow you. And we place, Lord, ourselves under your care, not only to watch over us and lead us, but to continue to give us understanding that we might be able to do what must be done for ourselves, for our children, for the rest of our brothers and sisters, in order for us to walk on firm footing into the future. So bless us, Lord. Bless the word that we've been pondering. Help it to sink deeply into our hearts and minds. In your name we pray. Amen.